Welcome to the Chris Wallace Chronicles.
One of my most memorable trips was to the Middle East. It was in the 60s. I went to visit my army buddy Jim, who was living in Beirut. Obviously, the area has since been ravaged by conflict, chaos, and corruption. But at that time, it was relatively peaceful. Beirut was called the Paris of the Middle East. It was a cosmopolitan city, and French was one of the official languages. But Paris? I don't think so. Beirut's beaches along the Mediterranean looked pristine, if you didn't look too closely. People would leave their garbage there after a day in the sun and just kick a little sand over it. It never took much to dislodge it. In fact, when it rained for a few days, it didn't just expose the garbage on the beach. Rivers of garbage flowed in the streets. When Jim showed me around the city, one of the places he pointed out was what looked like a big pit that had been carved out of the ground. It was filled with tents and signs of domesticity. This was the space the Lebanese had set aside for the Palestinians who had been displaced by Israel. It didn't look very comfortable, but it seemed to be all that was made available. The first place we went was Byblos. Mind you, this part of the world saw civilization after civilization come and go. Byblos was first occupied between 8800 and 7000 BC. Over its history, it was part of the Egyptian, Phoenician, Assyrian, Persian, Greek, Roman, and Ottoman empires. The Bible got its name from Byblos. It's where the Greeks and then the Romans got papyrus, which they used to make writing material. It's where the word paper comes from. The ruins of these great structures in Byblos were there before the Acropolis or the Colosseum was even thought of. It makes me think of a Carl Sagan quote. He said, "We are butterflies who flutter for a day and think it is forever." Another place we went that had the same kind of vibe, only not quite so old, was Baalbek. It had only been populated for the last 8,000 years or so. There were two temples there that were in remarkable condition. One was a Roman temple to Jupiter that was built on the site of a previous temple from Alexander the Great's time. The other Roman temple was dedicated to Bacchus, the god of agriculture, wine, and fertility. My permanent reference point for Bacchus is in Walt Disney's Fantasia, the original one from the 40s. Bacchus was depicted as a happy drunk, rolling back and forth on top of a donkey to the tune of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. I have to be honest, though. Byblos and Baalbek didn't conjure the same romantic image for me as, say, the Parthenon or Delphi. They're beautiful and remarkable, but when I look at the photos I took, I wouldn't know one from the other if they weren't identified. However, it wasn't long before I was face to face with a truly unforgettable structure, Coq de Chevalier in Syria. Coq de Chevalier is a castle built in the 12th century. Lawrence of Arabia called it the best preserved and most wholly admirable castle in the world. And it is. Well, it was until the Syrian Civil War. But what I saw was what Lawrence of Arabia saw, a castle as it had been for 900 years. They couldn't have picked a better spot for it. It dominated the landscape. Nobody could have snuck up on those boys unless they dug a 50-mile tunnel. We had a guide at the castle, a Syrian man who'd lived in Chicago for a while. He asked us if we noticed the people in the village at the base of the castle. We hadn't, so he explained. Many of them were lighter complexioned than most Syrians. Some even had blonde hair. Why? Because 2,000 crusaders, soldiers, were billeted in that castle. 2,000! The village had women in it. You do the math. Those 2,000 soldiers found, let's say, comfort in the village. It may not have been quite so comfortable for the women of the village, but that's the way things were in those times, as the genetic legacy testifies. The castle itself was virtually intact. There were turrets and moats and walled portions inside of other walled portions. It was vast. It had that stonework up on top where you could shoot arrows from, or throw spears from, or dump hot oil from, usual castle stuff. We must have walked around there for at least an hour or so. It was a work of art, perfectly proportioned, magnificent craftsmanship, and in beautiful condition. It's now a World Heritage Site and one of the seven wonders of the modern world. That stop at Coq de Chevalier would have made the whole Middle Eastern trip worthwhile. But we had an even bigger thrill in store. Damascus. Just the name fills you with exotic images. Damascus is one of the oldest continuously populated cities in the world, from the second millennium BC. Just to give you an idea what that means, London dates from 47 to 50 AD. Tokyo was a fishing village named Edo in 1603, and New York was a Dutch trading post in 1624. Damascus has been around for a hell of a long time. We went straight to the old city and went from the afternoon sunlight, literally through the ruins of a Roman temple, and into the dark, claustrophobic bazaar of Damascus, the souk. Stall after stall of things for sale. Most of what I saw was utilitarian, like shoes, articles of clothing, utensils, that kind of thing. One amenity I noticed in the souk was a faucet sticking out of the side of a building with a single tin cup next to it. That was the public drinking fountain. There was a man having a drink when I went by. Eventually, we came to this huge open area, also from the Roman era, but since repurposed. This is where we found the Great Mosque of Damascus. I had to go inside, so Jim and I took off our shoes, washed our hands and faces, and entered one of the most magnificent mosques on earth. There were people scattered around here and there in various stages of prayer. Enormous Persian carpets, the largest I've ever seen, covered the beautiful tiled floors. I remember reading once that there's always a little flaw intentionally woven into a Persian carpet, because only Allah is perfect. It's claimed that John the Baptist is actually buried at a shrine in the mosque. John the Baptist! There's a mausoleum where the great Islamic leader Saladin is buried. There are references to St. Paul having been there at some point in his ministry. And that's just the stuff we know of. The history has been piling up there in so many layers that they can't even excavate to see what's down there. When you think about it, there must be thousands of places on our planet where civilizations have existed and have been built over, and we've never heard of them. Carl Sagan, butterflies. Jim and I said our goodbyes, and I was off on an adventure of my own, to Cairo. Jim suggested that I stay at Mena House, which has a colorful history of its own. It was originally built as a royal hunting lodge for the Khedive Ismail. He was the ruler during the Ottoman occupation. Anyway, it's located right at the edge of the Sahara, next to the pyramids. A lot of important events have taken place there over the years. Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin had a Big Three conference there. Carter, Sadat, and Begin met there as a part of the Camp David Accords. And now, I showed up. This was my first experience in a strict Muslim country. Beirut was much more multicultural. Cairo had rules, and I learned them as I went along. One I caught on to quickly was that everybody could put out his hand at any time and ask for money. I couldn't go anywhere that I didn't have at least a half a dozen guys offer to guide me. When I was standing at a bus stop waiting for a bus into the city, a guy offered to guide me onto the bus. For a small fee, of course. Another guy accosted me as I got off the bus with an offer to take me to a museum, or a perfume parlor, or a citadel. I managed to blow him off, but as soon as I was passing one of those perfume parlors, it felt like I was on Bourbon Street walking past a strip joint. The owner rushed out at me. "We have a lovely potion made of 16 exotic Egyptian flowers. We have jasmine and lotus. Would you like to try an amber cigarette? Come in and drink a Coca-Cola." He rubbed some jasmine perfume on my arm and said, "The more you rub, the more aromatic it becomes." He wasn't wrong about that. Even without the rubbing, I thought I smelled a little too sweet. I love the smell of jasmine, just not on me. When I got back to Mena House, I went to the lovely gardens for a cup of tea. I sat under an orange tree, and the large fruit dangled there within reach. I'd never seen oranges growing before. When I told my waiter, his response was to ask me for an American silver dollar. When I opened the curtains in my room and stepped out onto a little balcony, I looked out on the Great Pyramid of Cheops. I decided I needed a closer look. I got that the next morning when I went out to where a number of men were tending donkeys, horses, and camels. Among them was a dignified-looking gentleman dressed in a beautiful blue flowing galabea. He wore a white head cover like a skull cap and had a large blue and white scarf around his shoulders. When he saw me approaching, he came toward me and extended his hand. "I am Mohammed, sir. How can I be of service to you?" "Well, I'd like to get a closer look at the pyramids and maybe see the Sphinx. Would you like to go on horseback or camel?" "Can I do both?" "Yes, sir. Come with me." So the first day I went out onto the Sahara with Mohammed was on a beautiful Arabian stallion. Mohammed wanted to see if I was comfortable on a horse, so he watched me as I mounted. I must have passed his test. He told me that Arabs ride differently from Westerners. "For us," he said, "it's like sitting in a rocking chair. We sit well back. It's how we learn." At one point, when he was confident that I knew what I was doing, he suggested we let the horses run. And boy, did they. You can't imagine the thrill of galloping across the Sahara with nary an obstacle in sight. Just sand. It turns out that Mohammed was more than just a guide. He was a companion. He took me to a place in the desert where we could have a cup of tea and chat. We spoke of things that we had in common and of brotherhood in general. A lovely man, I'll never forget him. He even suggested we go out to a nightclub in the desert that evening. I remember it was called Lue. The floor show was made up of local acts, as it were. There was a singer accompanied by some exotic instruments. Well, exotic to me. There was the obligatory belly dancer. But the most exotic of all were the whirling dervishes. I didn't know there actually was such a thing. But these male dancers came out in silky robes, and as the percussionists played this haunting rhythm, it reminded me of Ravel's Bolero, they spun around and around and around in absolute ecstasy, their robes full and flowing for an unimaginable length of time. You got dizzy just watching them. But one thing that I was sure of was that however exotic these performers were, from their point of view, they'd have been happy to have a gig. Show business. The next day, I noticed a group of European tourists at Mena House. Their guide was a Swedish woman, probably in her 30s. Let's call her Inga, since I don't remember her name. When we discovered that she had some time off, I asked her if she'd like to go on a camel ride with me in the Sahara. I found Mohammed, and he arranged it. Now, I don't know how much experience you've had riding a camel, but that was my maiden voyage. Once a camel is up on all fours, it's a piece of cake. But getting there was, let's say, challenging. I'd be leaning my weight one way, expecting, say, the front end of the camel to rise, and it'd be the back end that came up, practically throwing me over its head. Or maybe it was the other way around. Then, as soon as I adjusted to that lurch, the other end rose and nearly threw me off in the opposite direction. Then there would be one more lurch, and I'd have to hang on for dear life. Once up there, like I said, it was a piece of cake. Mohammed showed us how to sit properly and comfortably, and he said a gentle kick in the side of the camel and the word harja would get it going. And by the way, if you go on a camel ride, remember to take some breath mints for the camel. Their breath is like, well, let's put it this way. You want to stay upwind if possible. We loped along, coming right up to the Great Pyramid of Cheops. From this close, you could see that it wasn't as smooth as it looked from the distance. The blocks of stone were like high steps that you could use to climb to the summit. There were over 2 million of them. Each one weighed over 2 tons. The thing was almost 500 feet high. The other two nearby pyramids were smaller, but not that much. These were all built by hand. No cranes, no lifts, no machinery, just people. And it was 4,600 years ago. Muhammad then led us about a kilometer away to the Sphinx. It has the head of a man and the body of a lion. One really weird thing about it is this. The nose is missing. The Sphinx was built around 2500 BC. One of the stories is that a Sufi Muslim broke the nose off in 1378 because some peasants prayed to the Sphinx for a good harvest and he didn't like it. So he chopped off the nose. The story continues that he was executed for vandalism. Another story that made the rounds was Napoleon shot it off with a cannon. Not very likely. It would have taken unbelievable aim to shoot a cannonball at the nose and miss everything else. The Sufi Muslim story is generally accepted as true. But the bottom line is, there ain't no nose on the Sphinx. I invited Inga to go into Cairo for dinner. We jumped in a taxi and were on our way. I had my arm on the seat behind her. I wasn't touching her. I just had my arm resting on the seat. The driver screeched to a halt, turned around, and yelled at me in Arabic, waving his finger and pointing to my arm. I finally got the message that having my arm behind her was just a little too intimate for his delicate tastes. There are a hell of a lot of Egyptians running around, so someone must have put his arm around somebody. But I digress. We went to the restaurant on the 41st floor of the Grand Nile Tower Hotel. Aside from the spectacular view, it had another feature. It was on a turntable, so that you'd eventually get a 360-degree panorama of Cairo. I'm guessing that the engineer who designed it ran out of money before he was able to perfect the turntable. It was supposed to glide around effortlessly and smoothly. Instead, it lurched from one sprocket hole to the next on its entire 360-degree journey. You had to time your bites between lurches, or else you'd end up with couscous in your lap. On the way back to Mina House, I didn't make the mistake of having my arm in the wrong place, but when we got there, there were attendants, I suppose, in every corridor. I know this because I walked Inga to her room, and there was a guy standing there, watching to make sure she went into her room alone, and I didn't hang around. They were everywhere. There was another one on my floor. He made sure I went into my room alone. Come on, really? Nevertheless, it was an amazing once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I got a couple of good stories out of it. I'm Chris Wallace.